Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Kia ora e te whanau. Did you hear that Conversations with Wahine is now an award-winning radio show? If you are passionate about our kaupapa and growing community and want to give your brand more visibility, why not sign up for one of our flexible sponsorship packages? To learn more, contact us on Instagram or Facebook. Conversations with Wahine, amplifying the voices of women.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with Wahine. Today you're joined with me, Harita, and I am joined with South African comedian Skalk Zaydenhout. He is a South African comedian and actor, and he spent his childhood in Kempton Park in South Africa. Skalk's creative and original points of contact during his performance make audiences identify and see the humour even in a bad situation. During his student years, he began to question issues about society, and that is how he decided to become a comedian, so that he could highlight strange views and customs in society in a light and comical way. In 2015, he was named the best in his peer group by Comics Choice Awards, and in 2018, the KYKNet television series, Die Where Nahid, was launched with Skalk as the writer of the text and newsreader, and Bibi Slippers and Ernst Grunlig as co-presenters of the program. They are just a few of the many achievements that he has had that we'll cover during this interview. Welcome, Skalk. How are you?
Thanks. Good. Good. And you?
Good, thanks. So I thought it would be really cool to interview you before you come to New Zealand next month and perform in Wellington. Yeah. So I'm really glad that we were able to organise this interview at quite a short notice as well. So first things first, what inspired you to try out and get into comedy?
Well, I was studying acting at the time, but I didn't get into the degree the first time I auditioned. So I was still then in a general BA, trying again to get into the acting course. And I had a lot of time on my hands, and I wasn't getting at the university because I wasn't in the course yet, really a lot of practical experience. And I guess I just wanted to get on stage. I just wanted to like be proactive and do something with my life and not just sit in my res room and watch series. Suits was the big series at the time. I was just sitting there wasting my life away watching Suits. And I thought, yeah, let me try some stand-up comedy. It looks cool. You know, I think I'm quite funny. And I tried it. And excuse me, I just woke up. and then I tried it, and it went quite well. And the second gig went quite well. And, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there. And it was a convenient time of my life because I then did get into the course. And I could study and do gigs on the side when I'm not so busy at university. So I never like, I could let it take its time to grow. You know what I mean? It was never like, I needed, you know, this thing to start making money now because I need to pay my bills. I was lucky enough that I was a student whose parents were still looking after him. And then by the time I graduated, I'd had, you know, at that point, quite a foot in the door in the industry.
That's really cool. And I think the fact that you weren't in a rush to, you know, make it big is probably what helped, because you weren't putting that pressure on yourself to, you know, sometimes people put so much pressure on themselves that they end up self-destructing because of the pressure.
Yeah.
And a lot of your comedy is about growing up in Kempton Park, which is near Johannesburg. And in quite a few of your shows, you've referred to it being a relatively small city or small town. I don't actually know how small it is, considering I've never been to South Africa. But tell us more about the ups and downs of growing up there, and, you know, the odd things that happen in society there?
Yeah, Kempton Park is an interesting one because it's part of the greater Johannesburg area. Johannesburg is massive. And then Johannesburg almost has all these little side areas, you know, like within the, yeah, within Johannesburg, you've got an area called Alberton, and you got Kempton Park, which forms part of the East Rand. And then in the East Rand, you have Kempton Park, Boksburg, Benoni, Brakpan Springs. And all those places form its own little community. So it's not as small as like everyone knows you, but it's small enough that you will see people that you know at the supermarket. There were two big, well, more than two, but like two main high schools, Afrikaans high schools, and between the two, you kind of knew who's who in the zoo. And then obviously the church on a Sunday is like a meeting place where everyone kind of will know each other. So it's not as like what you see in the movie, small town vibes where there's, you know, 100 people living there. But it was small enough that I felt it didn't feel like big city life growing up. We didn't have big skyscrapers and stuff like that. So yeah, it was great because I feel we had a cool childhood in the sense of like we had a community, you know. You would ride your bike to another kid's house and spend the afternoon there. Our parents didn't always know where we were, so we had like a little bit of that small town growing up feeling without actually living in a small town. And yeah, I think in a big city, it's easy that you could get like a bit lost, you know?
It kind of like the way you're describing it seems kind of like Wellington in a way, where you do see a lot of people that you know around, but you don't particularly know everyone. And it's got a lot of things a big city has, yet it's not a big city.
Yeah, I've been to Wellington, and Wellington reminds me a lot of Cape Town, where Cape Town is like a relatively small city, like the city bowl. So if you've been living there for a while, you know kind of who the social circles, you know, you kind of get to know people. You get to know who you, yeah.
And what did success in a small city like Kempton Park look like to you when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I dreamed big. Like when I was growing up, I thought Hollywood, baby, Hollywood, win an Oscar. And it's before I discovered stand-up comedy or even knew what that really is or meant. I think my view of success now maybe looks a bit different, but I think for most people, just success was getting married, having children, and yeah, having a job where you can comfortably, you know, pay your bills, buy a house, go on holidays, whatever that job may be. You know, I think we in a place like Kempton Park, you did see a lot of struggle. You know, there's big parts of Kempton Park where people aren't living lavishly. I would say in general it's a middle class community, but you know, even my household like definitely didn't not have food on the table, but we certainly weren't going on overseas holidays. And I think success to everyone just looked like you just don't want to struggle one day. You just want to live comfortably and enjoy life. But then our work consumes us so much that there's almost no time to be able to enjoy life. So I'm still personally trying to find that balance.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like that everywhere. So when you were dreaming of like going to Hollywood and things like that, did anyone ever tell you that that was a silly thing to dream of?
No, I mean, because I was the, I think I had almost the opposite. You know, I had a lot of false hope, because I was the actor in my school, you know, and it was sort of definitely a big fish in a small pond. And because you're always the one on stage doing silly things and acting and going crazy, you know, people would often be like, yeah, you are going straight to Hollywood, my man. You don't forget us when you're receiving your Oscar one day. And then you exit school, and then you're like, it's not just, you know, get on a plane and go to Hollywood, and there you are. And hello, I'm here for my Oscar. Kind of opportunities have to happen, and it's a long road of things that need to happen before you win an Oscar. So yeah, I actually think in school I had this false idea that it was going to be a lot easier than it is. Now I'm trying to just get a visa for America to go do some stand up there. That's even proving a big challenge.
Yeah, I think especially right now, given
Yeah.
how America is with their with outsiders and immigrants. I like the fact that when you were growing up, people supported your ambition though, because I feel like a lot of the time, whenever kids are, you know, kids say, oh, I want to go to Hollywood, I want to be in movies and things like that, there will always be parents or someone saying, oh, that will never happen, or you know, you have to be more realistic. But you know, the fact that your school actually said to you, yep, you're going to make it. Like, I feel like that type of thing is what helps someone continue with that dream rather than being shut down all the time.
Yeah, I definitely think I had the support of my peers, and look, in high school more, primary school, you get bullied for being the drama kid.
Yeah.
It's not something that's celebrated as much, I would say, in terms of it being cool. It makes you popular, everyone knows who you are, but I'm assuming New Zealand's the same. It's very rugby focused,
Yep.
and being different doesn't get celebrated so much when you are younger. Only once you get older, the differences are celebrated more. And yeah, and then especially at university when I started stand up, I think I was quite weird and quirky to people, and that really made me stand out.
Yeah, New Zealand is a lot like that. And then, yeah, those people that stand out always like they end up like being kind of late bloomers because during their childhood, they're constantly being told, no, you have to fit in, you know, like you have to play sport, you have to do this. Like especially if you're a boy doing acting and musicals and things like that, they're always told to, you know, so they can't really be their true selves until they get into high school and university and things like that. Yeah, very similar.
Yeah.
So now, is comedy your full-time job?
Yes. Comedy is my full-time job. I'm onto it at the moment, in Europe and UK, and go back to South Africa, and then it's only a week home, and then off to New Zealand and Australia. So yeah, it's a very taxing job that takes you away from home a lot, and you're on the road a lot. But you know, the shows are rewarding, and the laughter and the applause.
And what were you working as before becoming a full-time comedian? Was there ever like a state, was there ever a phase where you were doing comedy gigs in the evenings and, you know, working during the day until you made it as a comedian?
No, lucky for me there wasn't, because the beginning years I was a student. So it was studying in the day and doing gigs at night. Or in my case, it wasn't studying behind books, it was practical classes, you know. Acting was very much hands-on on the floor. So it would be maybe rehearsing for a play in the day, and then in the evening, in the evening doing gigs. Often we would rehearse in the evenings for plays, and then you just wouldn't book any gigs for then. Sometimes there's be 2, 3 weeks where I just don't do any gigs. But I mean, it was, like I said, I'm in a very privileged position that I didn't have, like, I think it must be very hard if you've got a job, especially a job that makes money, like good money. And then every comedian has at some point to get to that pivotal moment where you go, am I going to quit this job and try and make it in comedy? And you're going to maybe take a pay cut for the first few months. And I've got a lot of friends who've done that, and I respect them a lot for it, because it's very hard,
It's a
especially
huge
sometimes comedians already have a wife and kids, and they have to go tell their wife, okay, I'm quitting my job that puts food on our table, and I'm pursuing comedy full time.
Yeah,
It's a
I
big deal.
interviewed a couple of months ago. I interviewed an Indian comedian who's relatively famous worldwide as well. And I interviewed him when he came to New Zealand, and he did exactly that. He worked, I can't remember the company now, but he worked, oh, I think it was Citibank. He worked at a global, like a global company in IT. And then when he decided he wanted to pursue comedy full time, he was already married. And exactly that, he told his wife, I want to pursue comedy full time. And I mean, luckily, he made it, but it was a huge risk because he had such a good job at such a good company. And he got to a point where he couldn't continue doing both. He had to kind of choose one or the other if he wanted to make it big in comedy. And also, like, living in India on top of that, there's the whole stigma behind it that, oh, you've left your 8 to 5 job for this. So there's a lot of risks that go with it. And I guess, not everyone makes it. So you have to take a very calculated risk at it as well. How did your family and friends react to you becoming a comedian? I'm assuming they would have always kind of seen it coming since you were studying acting and you were always along that route anyway. But when you decided to pursue it full time, were they supportive and, did they react the way you thought they would?
So my family and friends, I guess, knowing me, they all went, yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense that this guy's doing stand-up comedy. My poor parents, because I think back then I also relied on swearing a lot more to try and land the joke. But it's just a natural thing that comedians do. It's like you don't have the comedic substance quite yet. And often swearing gets a laugh. So then you rely a bit more on swear words to get the punchline across and get it over the line. And I think that was a bit hard for my parents. It's just like going up on stage and it's so public and just swearing so much. And then obviously trying to invite people to come to shows, but the content might be a bit not their cup of tea. But eventually I also got better at my craft and was able to do shows that are entertaining with, I still swear on stage, but not so much. Shows that my mom can actually bring some friends to that will enjoy it. And my comedy's evolved a lot. This new show is quite deep, quite sincere. It's called Hey Hey Divorcée. So it's a show about my divorce, which is quite deep and personal, yet still funny and entertaining. So I never thought when I started out I'd be able to one day do a show that can make people laugh and cry in the same show almost. So I'm proud of myself that I've managed to achieve that.
And What was your inspiration behind this show? Obviously, it's, from your divorce, but what made you
Yeah.
think I can make this into a show rather than keeping what you went through private and away from the public eye?
Yeah, I mean, there was no way I could keep it private. In South Africa, I am quite known, and eventually it was going to happen that the tabloid media would start realizing I'm not wearing my wedding ring. Or they would have realized that I don't post about my wife anymore because I share a lot of my life on my social media. Then there's also the question, like if I've got a new girlfriend, at some point I'll have to share her on social media, and it can't then go from, wait, he's married, now he's got a girlfriend. So with social media, you also take the you firstly let the audience into your life, and you take them on a journey. They go through your ups with you the same way that we share all our accomplishments on social media. You win a prize, you achieve something great, you share that on social media, and you go, hey guys, I got a promotion at work, and hey guys, I got a new car. That's the type of stuff people put on social media. But unfortunately, part of the journey is not just ups, it's downs as well. So, I shared my wedding a lot, pictures of, everyone knew what our wedding looked like. And then it suddenly ended. And I didn't, for like 2 months, I just kept it a secret. And people are very clever. I started seeing people. It happened more and more and more. Where's your wife? Where's your wife? Yeah, we haven't seen her in a while. You haven't said anything about her. What's going on? People already started becoming suspicious. So I didn't really have a choice, Like I had to at some point after 2 months say, hey guys, bad news. And it was easier to announce it on social media because then, like, it's almost like everyone knows at once, and you can. It's not something that has to drag on for ages, even though it did, because not everyone sees the news immediately. So even 6 months later, I'm posting my new girlfriend, and someone's like, "Aren't you married?" And it's like, "Yes, I was. That was 6 months ago that I said not anymore." But anyway. And yeah, then obviously the tabloids wrote articles about it, so it was kind of all over the place. Especially because the marriage didn't last very long, so I think that made it also a little bit scandalous, which made them eat it up more because it's like, oh, it was only 2 years. So yeah, and then obviously it was a very painful time. It still is, divorce is something that you heal from for years to come. It's like a death. It's, of a father or a mother, or a child. It's not something that it's just over in a year and you're like, cool, thank you, close the chapter. And I think at the very beginning, even I thought to myself, the only way that something positive can come from this, because it just felt all bad and all negative. I thought the only way something positive could come from this is if I can turn it into art, and my art is comedy. So, and it's exactly the same if you think about it as Taylor Swift writing an album after a breakup.
About her breakups. Yeah.
This is my breakup album.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking as you were talking. I was like, yeah, she pretty much writes a song about every relationship and every breakup she's had. So, yeah, same type of thing. And then
Yeah.
when you're writing your shows, how do you decide what to include and what to exclude? Like, I know you include a lot, but is there anything that you keep off limits? Or do you think, oh, before I put this in the show, I better ask this person if they're okay with me including it? Do you have things like that?
Often, like, I will, if it's a story, like, it's just a silly story about a friend, sometimes I will even use their real name. If it's a good friend of mine, I know they wouldn't mind me telling this story. But it's quite an easy fix to just sometimes change a name. In this case, in the show talking about my ex-wife, unfortunately, the people who are big
They know,
fans would
yes.
know who I'm referring to. She is a real person in the world with a face. So yeah, I just had to be very careful. I didn't ask her what can I say or not about you, because obviously, and someone who's not a comedian doesn't always understand, what we do and how we do it. So it was just a matter of, like, I just need to feel comfortable with what I'm saying. I just need to feel comfortable that I'm not, breaking this person down or breaking their character down. But I wasn't too worried about that, because that was never the purpose of the show. The purpose of Hey Hey Deeble Say was to talk about my pain during the divorce as a thing, marriage as a concept, my experience of the divorce. It was never really to talk about her as a person and how she is and that she's terrible or whatever. It's not, it was never supposed to be that. But obviously some stories, like, she does come up, but yeah, I don't go into any detail about her character. Yeah, which also I had to just, check myself, because you could get sued for that.
Yeah, exactly. I know there's a lot of comedians get sued for things that they talk about, and yeah, it's a bit, I guess it's a bit of a fine line, right? Because you're talking about your life, but you have to be careful about who else you're talking about or what other things you're talking about.
Yeah.
So you got your big break by being an opening act for Trevor Noah back in 2015. How
Yes.
did that happen? Did you have to audition, or did he somehow come across your work? And how was that experience for you? Because that must have really changed your life.
Yeah, I guess when he sees you live, that is your audition in a way. He wouldn't just choose someone who's he's never seen live before. So yeah, he we did a comedy festival together. He saw me and I said, please just watch my set, I really want to open for you. And he did, and yeah, I ended up opening for him quite a few times, actually, in various years. And it was amazing. He's got very adoring audiences, and he's groomed his audience to expect an opening act. So they know all his shows is going to be an opening act, and they get ready for the opening act, and they are very gracious towards the opening act, because they understand and they realize this is a young comic who Trevor is giving an opportunity. And if you're good, they celebrate you. And they are the type of audience that if they like you, they will actually follow you beyond Trevor's show. Like, when Trevor's show is finished, they will actually look you up and follow you and come to your shows. I still get shows that people attend that they go, I started coming to your shows after I saw you open for Trevor Noah. And the great thing it does is just because he's the numbers you're talking are, like, insane numbers, ten sometimes when I was first open for him, it was 2,000 people a night, but this was in a month. So it's
Wow.
just 6 days a week. Every night there's 2,000 people seeing me that they've never heard of me. So the exposure is massive. And I really respect him that. What I always tell people is Trevor really doesn't need an opening act. The audience, he doesn't need someone to warm. Opening act normally warms up the crowd. He doesn't need someone to warm up the crowd. They are so, They love him so much. When he walks on, trust me, they are warm already. But he still uses an opening act because he realizes what a great opportunity it is for them.
That's really cool. And yeah, he's amazing. I've seen him live before when he's been to New Zealand a few times, and he's so good. And also like the stuff he does on TV. Yeah, I also feel like South Africans have this like very like, I don't know, it's a very niche type of comedy. But even though he's from South Africa and you're from South Africa, it's still very relatable. To us, you know, we've never been to South Africa, but a lot of the stuff you guys talk about, we kind of know the context somehow and we can relate to it as well. Yeah, it's very cool that he gives people an opportunity though, because you find, yeah, a lot of people get to this point in their fame where they're just like, oh no, the sh whole show can just be about me now because I don't need anyone else. And do you still get nervous before gigs? And if you do, how do you deal with the nerves?
I have a glass of red wine. That's pretty much it. I like seeing friends before a show as well. It's easier for me to go before a show and just like chat to some people, because then you almost force yourself to not think about the show and to just hang out. And then, but at that point, you don't have to think about the show. You've done the prep. I've done the new material shows. So at that point, I just want to actually distract my mind, because if I start thinking too much about the show, I'm going to overthink it. And sometimes it's just nice to go on stage with like a rough plan and just let the plan play itself out from there and just go with the flow.
And have you ever had, or have you ever done a gig that has gone horribly wrong? And if so, how did you recover from it?
Well, yeah, lots, you know. I don't think I've had a one-man show that goes horribly wrong. But I mean, there's nights in Edinburgh, Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where you've got 20 people in a 120-seater, and it's quiet. And from the first joke, they don't really laugh. They're not really there with you. And you don't really have a choice, you know. You just have to push through and you have to do the show. And you have to try, and this is the difficult part. You have to try it with the same enthusiasm that you would have with a sold out crowd. Because it's not their fault that there's 20 of them, you know, and they bought a ticket to come to the show. And often they're just not laughing because they feel very shy. Because there's only 20 of them and they kind of feel awkward. But there's this comedian once that said, "Don't let a good show go to your head and don't let a bad show go to your heart." So I think recovering from it, yes, that evening you probably will feel a bit sad, and maybe even for like a week after that. But you just have to put that show behind you and, you know, look forward to better shows.
And then I guess you use it as practice for the next one as well.
Yeah, I see it the same as like, you know, if a doctor loses a patient, that must be a very traumatic thing. But then the next day you've got another operation and another opportunity to save a life. And you can't now let that patient the previous day dying keep you from saving the next day's patient. You just have to kind of learn to process it quite quickly and move on. Otherwise, if you let every death of a patient influence the next patient, then they're going to die, and 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 all your patients are going to die. You have to kind of, you know, reset, press the reset button.
That's very true. What are the best and worst parts of being a comedian who performs around the world?
Well, the best part is definitely, I mean, you get to see the world, which is most people's dream, you know. The worst part is, you know, when you travel the world, you just get a new appreciation for your house. And I've come to the conclusion that I think by nature, human beings are just never satisfied. I don't think there is something that will ever satisfy us completely, because people who have an 8 to 5, they are just saving money, saving money, saving money, so that they can get out of their house and go on holiday, and they just want to get out of their house. You know, and you'll hear people say that, oh, you know, I just want to get out the house and go somewhere else, go see somewhere else. I see and go so many places on this tour. You know, I'm doing it like almost a different city every night. When I'm in New Zealand for a week, it's every night different city. I've got a new appreciation for my home. When other people, they want to save up to get out of their house, I want to get out of hotels and go to my
Back home.
house. I would kill to just be in my house now for a week. That's why I've tried to break up the tours in such a way that I go for 2 weeks, go back for 2 weeks, go for 2 weeks, go back. And people say to me, yeah, but that's so much flying that you have to do then. And I'm like, I will do the flying if it means I can just go home and be at my house for even just a few days, see my dog, just be on my own couch, sleep in my own bed. Like that's what recharges me.
Who
So
takes
yeah,
care of your
it comes
dog
with a
while
lot
you're
of, I've got a pet sitter who works for me like on a permanent basis. So when I'm not there, she's there. But it's sad, you know, to think that my dogs, that she's lovely and they love her, but eventually they probably see her more as the owner than me, because they see her more often. This year is particularly bad again with traveling. I'm traveling a lot this year. But yeah, work hard, play hard, I guess.
Yeah, it's very true. I think like people never really satisfied with what they have, right? You always want the opposite. Like just like you were saying, like us people that work office jobs, we're always looking for the next holiday. Or like when we're talking to friends, it's always like people always ask you a question, do you have any holidays planned this year? It seems to be a question that everyone asks everyone. Whereas yeah, if you're always traveling, it's like, oh, when's your downtime going to be? So it's always the opposite. You've
Yeah,
also
and I think with the 8 to 5, you also have a lot of structure in your life. You get up same time. Like my girlfriend has now started an office job, and I'm actually so jealous of her, because she gets to arrive at work 7:30, have a coffee and something to eat, and sit down. She's seeing the same people every day. You know, every day I'm getting to a new airport, looking around, okay, where are the Ubers? Every day it's figuring it out, okay, how do I get from year to year? It's hotels and Ubers, and it's a different scenery every day, which can get exhausting, you know. Like I crave that routine and familiarity. That's why when I'm on an acting project, it's actually really nice, because you get to go to the same place every day and see the same people every day, which is lovely.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way. And also, like when you're touring around the world, it's also different languages. You're going to countries where they speak, they might not be predominantly speaking English or, a language that you understand as well. On the note about acting, so you've acted in a few movies and you've also written a book. Tell me more about those projects.
Yeah, the movie projects, like I said, it's always like a welcome change of scenery, because I'm actually in, then I'm not traveling, you know. Like I'm normally away from home, because we don't Normally, they don't normally shoot movies where I live, but still, you feel closer to home just because, like, in distance wise, you are closer to home, closer to home. In Cape Town, I'm only like 1,500 kilometers away from home. At the moment, I'm in Belgium. God knows how many kilometers away from home. So on the movies, it just can get you into a bit of a routine because my work is at night, so then I can for change work in the day and sleep at night like a normal person. And with stand up, yes, you can record a special and it can exist after the tour, but a movie is so satisfying because you work on this project that you're only seeing the little bits and pieces, and it's hard to see the full product. But then eventually there is a full product, and you can actually go watch an hour and a half of a month and a half's work that you put in, and actually have a deliver an entertaining product to people, which is it's a great feeling. Like, so much hard work goes into it, and then suddenly it's packaged into this small little file. It's actually crazy.
And tell us about the book that you wrote. I think it was back in 2018.
Yeah, I wrote a book with a friend. It was just like kind of my life up to then. Wrote about the start of my career, wrote where I was at. In retrospect now, I mean, I'd like to write part two. More, I think the book would have been more entertaining if I wrote it now, because so much else has happened since. But it was just an opportunity that came over my way, and it wasn't a biography, because I mean, I was certainly not at the end of my life. In fact, I was still at the beginning of my career. So it's like, how do you write a book at your about your career? It was more just like kind of an entertaining book of funny stories that that's happened on the road, where I was, where I am, where I want to be. It was just kind of sharing stories and giving people some context to the people that at the time were becoming fans of mine, giving them some context to where I grew up. And who I am, essentially.
And when you were growing up, who were your inspirations? Like, who did you look up to?
I always tell people, like, stand-up comedy in South Africa wasn't like such a big thing. We didn't have stand-up really on television. There were a handful of comedians. The one comedian that was a big influence on me was his name is Casper de Vries, but his shows were like, it was almost like a variety show, cabaret, a sketch show. He had small bits in between where he would just talk as himself, which was stand-up comedy. But then a lot of like songs and little dances, and he would get dressed and come back as a character. A lot of audio visual stuff. Actually, quite revolutionary because he was doing that at a time where not a lot of people were doing that at all. I think he was just a big influence in terms of me thinking, wow, that looks so amazing to perform live and just have people laugh so much in your show. So his name is Casper de Vries. He was fantastic. But like seeing comedy the way I do it, just normal, pure stand-up comedy, just with the microphone. Yeah, I didn't really have that. But I think what helped with that was that when I started, I was just original. I wasn't trying to imitate someone who I was a fan of, because you do sometimes see that on stage with new guys. They perform like a mini Dave Chappelle. They perform like a,
Yeah.
and And they have to work so much harder to find their own original voice because it's like you can't do Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle already exists. He already is doing his style of comedy. You have to find something. What's your style? What's your comedic voice? What, how, where are you on the scale of dark or not? Where are you on the scale of swearing? Are you a comedian who swears a lot or not at all, like Jerry Seinfeld? Or are you somewhere in the middle? Like I eventually found my swearing style to be somewhere in the middle. It's not a lot, but it's not at all. How sexual do you get in your shows? Is it very hectically sexual, and almost crass, or is it sort of just like a naughty joke here and there? You just have to, you have to find that, and that just comes with spending time on stage, I think.
Very true. And I guess, yeah, if you're trying to imitate someone, your audience will pick up on it very quickly, and they'll probably know, oh, he doesn't sound so genuine because he sounds like he's trying to imitate someone else.
Yeah, exactly. And you want people to remember you. You don't want people to walk out and go, yeah, he was that Dave Chappelle guy. Because now they're not remembering your name. They're remembering the guy who you just reminded them of.
And in your time working as a comedian and also as an actor, have you noticed a difference in how women in these industries are treated compared to men, and also how different ethnicities are treated?
South Africa, like ethnicities, have always been treated equally, I find, in the South African comedy scene. I can't speak about other scenes, but I've always found it to be the it was based on funny, which is the only metric you should use in comedy. But there wasn't comedians that were hilariously funny that weren't getting opportunities. It just wasn't. If you were funny, you were going to perform. That's as easy as that. And you would get opportunities. Yeah, female comics, I would say when I started, it has grown a lot. Yeah, there's also just more. Because when we started, there was only like one or two, and then they do kind of feel like, kind of like, oh, they're a minority. But I feel the world is, it's maybe not perfect yet, but it's really getting there. I feel like promoters are also making more of an effort to try and have women on the lineup. Comedy festivals are having all women lineups. But I do understand it's still got a far way to go. But you know, also just these days, female comedians are just so funny that you can't ignore them. You know, like I said, when we were starting out, the one or two female comedians in our industry, I wouldn't want to follow them. I wouldn't have wanted to follow them on a lineup. They were too funny. They would bring the house down. So that's what I say. Like, I just feel in South Africa, it was quite, we weren't so obsessed with like race and women, men. It was really just the funniest people would be on the shows and get the big shows. It
That's
was.
good. And I just remembered, is it Ursula Carlson? Is she quite famous in South Africa? Because she's originally South African, but mostly based in New Zealand and Australia for quite a few years now.
No, interesting enough, and she's never like really toured there that I know of. I think some people will know her name, but I think she definitely has been adopted more by the Kiwis than the South Africans, because she didn't do comedy when she was in South Africa. She only started in New Zealand.
Interesting.
So she, yeah. She's not prominent, I would say, in South Africa. Be interesting to see, if she had to go tour there, how many people would know her. But also the places she does so well, in especially Australia, it's so far from us, it's like that PR doesn't quite reach South Africa.
And one of my friends who's a huge fan of yours, she's South African as well, she asked me to ask you this question, that the current place that you live in, Ballito, I think, if I pronounced it correctly, which is a coastal town, and she wanted me to ask you if you've had any encounters with wild baboons or geckos there.
Yeah, there's monkeys in Belita, not baboons. Baboons are kind of next level scary and dangerous. In the Cape, there's baboons. The monkeys in Belita, yes, I've had encounters. It's you kind of have to get into the habit. Which I normally like, which you don't at all have in a place like Johannesburg. It's like every time you leave, you have to close all your windows because the monkeys could come in and steal food. But I've never, because of my two dogs, I've never had quite an issue with monkeys. I can leave my doors open and stuff. My dogs want those monkeys really bad, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, the monkeys, I think they know what would happen if they had to enter the house.
And just lastly, before we finish up, what are your social handles so our listeners can follow your work and keep up to date with what you're up to?
On Facebook, it's called Passade Note. On Instagram, it's Skulky Bears. And yeah, that's where I advertise all my shows, and my website's called Paseno.com, where it shows all my tour dates for New Zealand, which is around the corner, actually. It's less than a month away. I think I fly on the 9th of March, and the first show is in Wellington on the 11th.
On the 11th.
So, yeah, exciting
So
stuff.
if anyone wants to buy tickets to that show that's on the 11th, it's at San Fran in Wellington on Wednesday, 11th of March, and you can buy tickets through Moshtix and Ticketek. Well, thank you so much for your time, Skulk. It's been
Thank
really
you.
cool chatting to you. And to be honest, when I first emailed you asking if you'd be interested in an interview, I didn't think I'd get a reply from you. So, and then when I actually
Oh,
got a
well,
reply,
I'm
and
glad I did.
the reply was from you and not even a PR person, I was like, wow, he emails everyone back himself. I thought that was really cool. I'm hoping to get to your show. I have a newborn baby, so it just depends on how he
Good luck
is.
with that.
My husband and I really do want to come to your show, so I'm hoping we are able to get my parents to look after my son and come along.
Great, yeah.
It's been really awesome chatting to you, and I wish you all the best for the rest of this tour and the New Zealand tour and the tours you have after that. Thank you so much.
Thanks. How's the weather there? How must I pack?
Today's really humid. This whole week has been
Okay.
very humid, but that's not normal. I feel
That is
like,
warm.
it's been very warm, but I don't think March will be like that. Wellington will kind of
Okay.
be humid for like a week, and then it will just rain and be quite cold, and then it will go back to 20 degrees. So I think by March it
Okay,
will be early
I can live
20s.
with. I'm at the moment in like 1 or 2 degrees, so 20,
Yeah,
20
it's better
sounds
than
good to me right
that.
now.
It never gets to 1 degree in Wellington.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cool. Bye.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding accessmedia.nz.